Have we gotten the quarterback situation completely right? No. Have we won enough games? No. Everything else is there.
No, it's not. It's very much not there. And you're very far away from completely right. And apparently you did win enough games. So up is down and down is up. But we continue to talk football now with Robert Mays. He's on Twitter at Robert Mays. He is the NFL writer and podcaster for The Athletic. He's with us on the Alpamonte Nissan Hotline. Alpamonte Nissan on North Avenue in Melrose Park, or at apnissan.com. You can check him out on the Twitch stream as well. Robert, how are you, man?
I'm doing well. I hadn't heard the audio of that before. I'd only seen it in text form, and it just adds another layer of absurdity to the entire enterprise.
That's the noun there is absurdity, and that's what we took from it, and that's what I continued to feel was being piled on by George McCaskey yesterday. What is your takeaway from what we learned about the Bears in the last day and a half?
I just think it's utter delusion. I just don't understand how you can think after watching the last 2 years unfold that these are the right people to take you where you want to go, which I think was some of the language that had been used during those press conferences. I think that looking at the overall body of work as a reason to do this, when you think about it from a win-loss perspective, is completely misguided, because the 12 games they won in 2018 were done with an unsustainable form of defense that had been overseen by someone who is no longer in the building. And I just don't think that what's happening on the offensive side of the ball, or with the methods they've used to pick the players, anything, and the processes that have been undergone in that building would lead you to believe that this can get better based on the current structure. I think that you're just kidding yourself. And I think that's exactly what the people there have done.
I am hanging on the fact that you said it was unsustainable defense, because you did a deep cut when it comes to studying Vic Fangio and how he inspired Brandon Staley. So I want to just follow up on that really quickly. What about that defense did you think was unsustainable as far as duplicating that success for this year?
Defense is just less sticky from season to season. So even if you have a really good defense, it's hard to be the very best defense, just based on bounces of the ball, turnovers, things like that. I mean, even the defenses that are excellent from year to year, I would think of the Seattle defenses in the early 2010s or the Mike Zimmer defenses in Minnesota over the last decade, they vacillate somewhere between the best defense in the NFL and the fourth or fifth best defense in the NFL. So while Vic Fangio did an unbelievable job, and we see what's happening with Brandon Staley, and I do think that their methodologies for defense is the right way to approach it, it's very hard to be the type of defense that can carry you to a championship year in and year out. Even if you're really good and the underlying philosophies behind it are strong, it's still hard to be a championship caliber number one defense in the league for multiple seasons in a row.
I think it's also because the rules have so incentivized offense. And I'm old enough to remember when these crusty coaches would say, well, yeah, throw the forward pass, three things can happen, and two of them are bad. And that's not true anymore because of how easily flags come out and of just the number of times you can get an illegal contact, the ways you can bait people into pass interference. I don't know why I would sink a ton of resources into trying to have this elite defense when, even if they're playing at the top of the game, even if they're bursting through the line and they tackle the quarterback, it's flagged as a personal foul because you're not allowed to tackle the quarterback anymore. So that's what makes me kind of crazy, is that it seems to me the league just wants you to score.
I think that's exactly right. And I feel like Alabama is a lot of ways the canary in the coal mine for some of this stuff. And the way that Nick Saban sees the game shaping, and also just the way that college is coming up to the NFL now. And the fact that Nick Saban would sit there and say, you can no longer win with great defense because good offense beats good defense, and has changed his philosophy and the way they've shaped that program down there, that's the type of stuff where I'm looking at it and thinking, all right, that makes a lot of sense. And even some of that trickle up that you've seen. I wrote a big story about Brian Daboll today, and a huge reason for the Bills' success is some of the RPO stuff that he was using at Alabama as the offensive coordinator and implementing that within the Bills system. So I think that you can take a lot from what's happening at the college level. And the fact that Nick Saban, who has shaped that level of football for so long, has said, we need to score a bunch of points. That's the only way we're going to keep pace here. I think that's something to pay attention to. And for the most part, you've seen that throughout the league. I think that organizations that are looking for head coaches in this moment have trended toward offensive head coaches for that exact reason. I feel like the bar to hire a defensive-minded head coach, because of how much more difficult it is to sustain success with one of them, has to be extremely high. I feel like the Robert Saleh hire with the Jets will be okay in time, and I think that their approach on offense makes sense. I just think that needle is so much harder to thread for a lot of the reasons that we're talking about.
You know, it's funny you bring up Alabama as that canary in the coal mine. I said for years covering college football that the spread offense practically ruined quarterbacks for the NFL. And we're finally seeing the two come together in a way that makes sense, both at the college and at the professional level. We used to always say, if this were a game in the SEC, you'd say it was a great defensive game if it came to bad offense. At what point do you think that started to change at the college level? Because we had the national championship game on Monday. That was an excellent example of the talent and the style that we're going to see them play in the NFL coming up.
I think that's a really good question. And I don't know exactly when the inflection point might be. I would say that the passing boom in the NFL started in like the 2011 season. If you look at a lot of those numbers, that's the year where Stafford had that monster season where he threw for 5,000 yards. Breeze also did. Rodgers won the MVP. So I think that's when things started to change in terms of how much teams are willing to open it up. And I think what happened in 2012 with Washington and Robert Griffin is a really good kind of moment there, where you saw Kyle Shanahan say, all right, we need to use the stuff that he did in Baylor to make him comfortable early. And I think that's now become the prevailing wisdom at the NFL level. I had a conversation with Bruce Arians recently about this, actually. And Bruce is as old school as it gets with some of this stuff. And he essentially said, early in a rookie quarterback's first season, you have to implement the stuff they did in college in order to make them comfortable. And that type of open-mindedness has been rare in the NFL more recently than the past 10 or 15 years. So I think that just a willingness to say, how can we allow our players to be more comfortable rather than this is what our offense has to look like? That shift has been really important. I also think that the way information travels has changed. It's so much easier to steal college concepts and just grab something off as a one-off thing from either a college game or something you saw in the NFL just because of the way technology has changed. So I think it's coming from a ton of different directions. But that convergence of all of that stuff, I think, has led to that overlap that you've seen from the college game and the pro game over the last 10 years or so.
I want to bounce something off you, Robert, that I've been thinking about a lot, and you're the perfect guy to ask this, because it was sort of in my mind when we saw the Bears have to de-nagify their offense for Mitchell Trubisky and change some concepts around. And I've always loved this from the book Blood, Sweat, and Chalk, when certain trends beget other things in almost a dialectic fashion, as the zone blitz arrives because of the West Coast offense, and then we get the Mike Martz concepts of multiple verticals. And that gives us the Tampa 2. And now we see the Andy Reid offense. I would tell you, I think football is homogenizing acceleratedly. There is a sameness now where the differences between systems are small. That we love to say that styles make fights, where you play a service academy and you know, ooh, triple option, look at this, and it's so different, and how do we stop it? Or we talk about what's happened in the MMA, where you used to have, you know, sumo guy against kenpo guy, and now there is a way everybody fights. There's a standard, it's homogenized, because they know, and like you say, they can watch tape and they know. I would believe, and I could make a case, that as a game, there is a new trending sameness with every year the coaches start to move around, with every bit of cross-pollination of systems. And I don't think it's necessarily a good thing for us as football consumers.
So here's what I would say to that. I think that is true to a certain extent. And right now I would say that sameness, especially on the offensive side of the ball, is the influence of that Shanahan-Kubiak play-action style offense. If you look at the teams that have been successful both this year and last year to a certain degree, and what's going to happen with this round of coaches. You know, Robert Saleh is bringing Mike LaFleur with him to run that offense in the Jets. If Arthur Smith gets hired by the Falcons, that's another person running that style of offense. I have long believed that is the easiest way to play offense. I mean, even when the Broncos were doing it in 97, 98, I was 10 years old. So I didn't have a evolved understanding of what was happening. But in like 08, 09, when I would watch those Gary Kubiak teams in Houston, the way that you married run and pass and could create explosive plays off play action, it just seemed to make things easier for their offense. Watching Matt Schaub throw for 4,300 yards and almost 40 touchdowns in 2009, I think that's a perfect example. And I think the league is caught up to that line of thinking. But even if the basis of the offense is the same, if you look at all the different versions of that system that you saw this year, Shanahan in San Francisco, Sean McVay, Arthur Smith in Tennessee, Matt LaFleur in Green Bay, all of that stuff, Kevin Stefanski in Cleveland, for example, it's all different. So even if you're taking the bones of the offense that's the same, even if your day one install is the same stuff that Gary Kubiak was doing 15 years ago, you're eventually going to filter that through your personnel such that it's different aesthetically. The version of that offense that the Packers are running with all of the RPOs, with all of the motion, with the ways they use their backs as receivers is significantly different than that version that the Titans ran because of the personnel that they had. So I remember talking to Andrew Hawkins about this, and he had played for Kyle Shanahan in Cleveland in 2014 and some of the staff that's still there in San Francisco. And I asked him, how much of that offense is the same when it travels from place to place? And he said only about 60%. And the other 40% ends up being dictated by your players. I recently had a conversation with Matt Ryan about this and how from year one to year two with Shanahan from 15 to 16, they streamlined it in the same way the Packers have this year. And it's just about having a dialogue. It's like, I like this route combination, even though you've never really done it like this before. So I always feel like even if there's a standard way that makes football easier, which I think this offense does, I still think that the personnel is always going to dictate it enough for smart coaches that it doesn't feel like that sameness is crushing down on us.
I just love listening to the Athletic Football Show podcast because this, I feel like, is just a sampling of what you guys bring on a practically daily basis. And your last episode, you talked about what you described as the Bears' delusion. And then you also talked about the slate of NFL games we have this weekend. You're going to the Rams and Packers game. You got an opportunity to go, and you're going to check it out. What are you anticipating about this game and, frankly, just being there?
I'm really looking forward to it. I went to my first game this season last week in Nashville, and even with a half-empty stadium and everything else, there's just something so cool about watching playoff football because I've always appreciated the way the Patriots handle the playoffs. They consider it fully as these one-week little seasons where you can do all sorts of different things and throw wonky game plans. So you really don't know what you're going to get. And even watching the Titans defense and the way they played last week was so different than anything we'd seen from them. It was so fascinating to see it unfold in real time. So I've always loved going to playoff games at Lambeau. It's always enjoyable. But to me, this game is all about the best defense in the NFL that Brandon Staley has shaped there going against arguably the best offense in the NFL. And that back and forth and the ways that some of how the Packers are going to try to play with the rules of that Rams defense and how the Rams have always stayed one step ahead, even when teams attack it in smart ways like the Seattle team did last week. I just think that it's a back and forth that is the reason I love football, the reason that you love the mechanics of it. This is the perfect matchup between an offense and a defense that knows exactly what they love to do and exactly how to throw counter punches when defenses try to stop that stuff.
You made me feel old when you say, well, you were only 10 years old when the Super Bowl Broncos were doing some of that stuff. Meanwhile, I was covering those Super Bowls as a reporter and sitting at a table with Alex Gibbs while he's using salt shakers to explain belly stretch plays and showing us, here the concept is this and how they block it up. And they sure made it look easy. And the fact that as good as Terrell Davis was, that very same offense, they found like 1,500-yard rushers just plugging them in. Olandis Gary, Mike Anderson, whoever they had in there, that was really the essence, the basis of so much of this wide zone one-cut stuff. And then when you brought in, once they married the RPO action to that, forget it.
It's so interesting because, you know, there now it's all about you can't just run wide zone offenses anymore. You can't just run zone running plays in every single play because fronts are constructed to stop them if you're going to consistently do that. And I think there was a cool inflection point last season for the Niners when they were rolling. They eventually went and they played against the Steelers, who have this really wide alignment on defense with those outside linebackers. And they understood, we're not going to be able to get to the edge on these guys. We're not going to be able to beat them around the perimeter like we do so consistently with other teams. So they started running power plays. They started using pullers and using trap plays. And that's what you see. It's kind of what I'm talking about filtering it through your personnel. The Titans run all of these different sorts of running schemes, even though it's an outside zone offense. And it's just so cool to watch. And, Dan, I'm so sad about not having Super Bowl access this year, because even if it was 1997, that's still how it is. You know, for 2 days a week at the Super Bowl, every assistant is available for an hour. And even still today, not a lot of people know what the offensive line coach looks like. If you want to go sit there and pick his brain for 15 minutes, you can. And missing out on that this year as a football nerd is like a genuinely disappointing thing for me.
And those are the guys who teach you football. And I've always said this, that when I started on the Bears beat, I was a basketball guy and a baseball guy. And thank God for Tony Wise. Yeah, when Dave Wannstedt is on, he's always talking about Tony, because that's his best buddy. But Tony was such a sweetheart when I would ask a question, and he'd roll his eyes at it. And I'm like, well, and then I'd say, you know what? Help me out. Help me ask better questions.
Yeah.
Help me understand the game. And then because we had this access, and I'd say, well, what is that when he says that cadence and they says over, I said, what's over? It's like, oh, well, it was very, you know, all this stuff that seems so hard to understand really isn't. And he's just like, yeah, over just means toward the tight end, under means away from the tight end. Like, oh, okay. And it used to be you ask questions and they'd teach you things.
Yeah, and there's some teams that are still like that, some places that are still like that. And I mean, I'm not old now. I haven't been doing this for very long. But when I talk to younger reporters or college kids, I always just tell them, try to ask questions that you genuinely want to know the answers to, because that genuine curiosity is recognized in people who know it. And if you seem like you genuinely care about learning the things that they like to do and wanting to learn more about it, people will often help explain it to you. And I think that happens all over the place. I mean, I had a long conversation with Brandon Staley in December. And I typically, when I'm doing those sorts of chats, I'm not that nervous. You know, I know I've done enough homework where I can be on good footing to ask the right questions. But I wanted to know so much that I had spent like 2 hours before we talked writing out all my questions just so I didn't forget anything, because there were so many specific elements to the defense that I wanted to know about. And he was more than willing to explain them. And I think that finding coaches who understand that a more widespread knowledge of the game is better for everyone, both for them and the football-watching public, that's a really nice little elixir to learn about it and be able to teach people about it.
That Brandon Staley article is great. You talked to him about not just what he's got going on with the Rams, but also Vic Fangio. I know it's pinned at the top of your Twitter, but can you give us a quick insight to what that article meant and the gist of it, because I thought it was great.
I appreciate that. It was so, if you look at, you know, obviously Brandon Staley's had fantastic success with the Rams, and the story was really about the ways that he's pushing schematic edges in the NFL, unlike defensive coaches. So if you look at the Rams and some of the numbers associated with their defense, they line up with two high safeties more often than any other team in the NFL. It's about 80% of the time. And they'll change to different coverages outside of that, but it allows you to be unpredictable. And that is really a departure from the type of defense we've seen from everyone except Vic Fangio over the last 10 years or so. People have become obsessed with the Seattle kind of cover three model. And you see it even now with guys like Dan Quinn and Gus Bradley getting defensive coordinator jobs instantly upon losing their old gig. And Staley essentially told me, I'm not going to line up with another safety in the box as a given on every single play. Because defenses too often, I think, in the NFL say, we're going to stop the run first and do everything else later. But just think about it from a practical level. As Brandon Staley said to me, it takes a lot of 5-yard runs to add up to a 50-yard pass. And the Rams have allowed fewer explosive passes than any team in the league right now because of the way they line up. They're essentially allocating their resources towards stopping the pass instead of stopping the run, which seems to align with how football should work in 2021, but that's not how most coaches think about it. So his willingness to kind of step outside, play in light boxes less often than anyone else, and say, we're going to make you beat us on the ground, you are not going to beat us through the air, has really given them an advantage that makes sense on paper, but no one else has consciously tried to use.
This was, I could go all day with this stuff. I really could, Robert. I really appreciate it. This is tremendous stuff. And thanks for carving out the time for us today.
Absolutely. Anytime, Dan. You know that.
That is Robert Mays, the Chicago-based national NFL writer for The Athletic. We've got a Bulls game tonight, too, and we've got maybe a different-looking Bulls team soon with Lauri Markkanen and Ryan Arcidiacono coming back at some point this weekend, if not tonight. But let's talk a little Bulls as we're going to get to see him once again. That's next on The Score.
I think it's good we're playing fast. But I look at it the other way, too. I mean, the pace is one thing, but I think you also got to look at, you know, how much you're scoring in transition. We haven't scored very well in transition. Like, that's an area we've got to get better at. I think a lot of the stuff that's out there, you know, from an analytics standpoint, there's a lot of different information. You know, for us, certainly the turnovers, you know, have been a challenge. I think defensively, we've got to get much, much better. You know, rebounding, we've been kind of like middle of the road, but I think we've been inconsistent there. We've had some good rebounding games and not so good rebounding games. I think our consistency needs to be better. But I think the pace for us, we need to play fast. We need to get up and down. We need to be a team that, you know, can generate and manufacture shots in transition.
Turnovers aren't a challenge, Billy Donovan. You're great at turnovers. That's not a challenge at all. The Bulls are awesome at turnovers.
Like turning over the ball? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
They are.
That's apparently no challenge at all, because that's something, the turnovers, they've absolutely got down at this point. And I find it interesting that the Lauri Markkanen, who was called by John Paxson a foundational piece, and maybe he is and maybe he isn't, but there's different eyes and different decision makers who are figuring these things out right now. What do you do if he comes back Sunday? I don't think he's coming back tonight, but the way this rotation is looking, and the way, look how well Thad Young is playing as being a veteran big and doing the things that he's always done throughout his career. Now that you don't have idiot face telling him to go stand in the corner, that he can actually be the player that you thought he was. And Gafford has been a pretty good backup center. That's where Markkanen had been. I'm really curious to see how they reintroduce him and what this does for the responsibility of these two guards in White and Levine to help Markkanen find the shots where he wants them. I don't know how they're going to do it.
Well, I think you're going to see the inevitable drop-off in minutes with Zach and Kobe, because they had been playing such high amounts of minutes, especially in the last two games against the Lakers and the Clippers. So we'll probably see the minutes go down for those two a little bit. But it goes back to what we've been trying to figure out for the last couple of years with Markkanen. How does he fit in on this team? And the whole question of, can he and X player coexist? The narrative for a while was, can he and Wendell Carter Jr. exist together on the same floor? I know Rick Camp has been asked this question a time or two as well on Bulls postgame, and feel free to chime in. But I'm still wondering, you know, I'm still wondering how that marriage all works out together. And Lowry's he's in a prove it year, right? I mean, this is the time. He's technically available tonight. He and Ryan Arcidiacono. So I don't know what happens there with the availability. Thunder's a good team to try a lot of this out on.
Yeah, because they suck. So, and we saw that during the preseason. Yeah. This is, you got a little more margin for error against the Thunder than you do against the Lakers or the Clippers. And as this is all happening, Patrick Williams, the second youngest player in the entire NBA, is causing some pretty powerful people to say some very nice things. And if you just watch him play and you look at his jumper and the way he moves, I'm not making a one-to-one comparison here, but he looks like Kawhi. I'm not saying as far as I'm not saying he's that good. Please don't take this the wrong way and know how I'm saying this. But
you're not the only person to have said it. Jason Goff has called him Baby Kawhi for weeks now.
The stuff that he does, and I noticed that it was actually my son was showing me, because on NBA 2K, you know, he and his friends do what they call builds, where you create a player and you get to pick these various traits. And as you go through the mechanics of building a player, you literally choose someone's jump shot, or you make an amalgam of KD's jump shot and this guy's jump shot. And he showed me like a side-by-side of Patrick Williams and Kawhi Leonard and how they release the ball, where the hand is positioned on the ball as they shoot, and also with the size of their hands. They both have enormous hands that I think it is fair to keep looking at him through that prism, because there may be some special there.
And when you talk about like the ball placement in the hand, I know that's something Kawhi's like shockingly talked about. Was that he actually has to like have the ball further up in his hand. It's not in his palm because, you know, it's like us with a Nerf ball or something.
Yes.
On inside. Him and Boban that pretty much have hands like that.
It's hard to, if you imagine shooting a free throw with a golf ball, like it is for some guys with big hands, like generally some of the best shooters, guys like Glenn Rice had teeny little hands. And you see a guy who can just get his whole hand on the ball and kind of drop it and kind of flick it, where Steph Curry sort of squeezes it out from his fingers, finding the pressure points is a huge challenge for these guys.
And what's weird with those, the difference between those two is Kawhi's shot's very flat. Where
not
obviously,
Will.
Yeah, Patrick Williams' shot, he said yesterday in AAU, when he'd be in AAU, sometimes he hit the ceiling or came damn close to it.
Can you imagine? Rob Schaefer tweeted this on the 9th. You talk about, so it's you, Goff, and LeBron James who compare him to Kawhi, Dan Bernstein. I don't know how you feel about that, but I'd say that's some good company. Rob Schaefer from NBC Sports tweeted, asked LeBron James of his impressions of Bulls rookie Patrick Williams, quote, long arms. He has Kawhi-type hands that I noticed out on the floor. So I knew I couldn't play with the ball much. You could tell he's laser sharp and just trying to get better. And then said Chicago.
I think he's going to be exceptional talent. Long arms. You know, he has Kawhi-type hands that I noticed out on the floor. So I knew I couldn't play with the ball much. You know, and you could tell that he's just laser sharp on just trying to get better and better. You know, didn't say much at all. I mean, I don't say much at all on the court, when I'm competing versus individual, unless things are said to me, but he just kept his, he just stayed sharp on the game plan. And, I think he's going to continue to get better and better, has a great in-between game. But if you notice his hands though, he has, you know, like I said, Kawhi type hands, that's going to benefit him a lot throughout the course of the season, throughout the course of his career. So I think Chicago has a good one. And, you know, he just has to continue to get better, continue to improve, you know, and see what happens.
That's heady stuff. That's heady stuff from the King. And I'm laughing because longtime Bulls fans will remember what Jerry Krause said. One of those Krausean scouting points when Elton Brand was drafted. Jerry's like, I remember when I met his mother, and I looked at his mother's hands, and she's got huge hands. And he was so impressed with Elton Brand's mother's hands. And that's just like, it was just peak Jerry Krause right there. But hey, it matters. It matters, especially on defense, you know, being able to lock people up. But a little Bulls basketball for you tonight on Sports Radio 670. And when we come back, we got baseball news. We have a signing by the White Sox that we probably knew was coming, and one by the Cubs that is also an invocation of a comp to an all-time great. We'll get to that next. Bernstein and Rahimi on The Score. It is International Signing Day in MLB. There are also some signings that are going to be coming down, arbitration numbers being exchanged. You have Bernstein and Rahimi on Sports Radio 670, The Score. We knew that the White Sox were likely to sign the number one international prospect, Yoelky Cespedes, the younger half-brother of Yoenis Cespedes, and he has agreed to a deal with the White Sox, $2.05 million, that, according to MLB.com. And now we have the news that the Cubs have agreed to a $3 million deal with shortstop Christian Hernandez, who is ranked sixth on MLB Pipeline's top 30 international prospects list. And if I'm not mistaken, he's sort of referred to as Baby A-Rod.
Yeah, he's drawing that comparison, isn't he? And I think it's because of the frame that they both had as teenagers. because he's 6'2", 175. That's what they have him listed as. And I could see that being a similar comp. But they like him as a shortstop, at least the prognostications that I've read. And I'm curious to see if he ends up in that Arizona Fall League or if he ends up in the Dominican Republic camp that the Cubs have. But it's a savvy signing. I like it. I like that move to get Christian Hernandez. It seems like a really good move for the Cubs. Those international signings, I've gotten more and more interested in them every single year. And for reasons like this, you see some amazing names come out of them later on in the league.
Yeah, I'm looking at his body right here. And if I can try to remember how A-Rod looked when I was doing play-by-play for him and when he was on the Appleton Foxes against the Rockford Royals, I can see those similarities. I really can. I mean, it's obviously you hate to put that on him early on in his career when we were doing the same thing with Patrick Williams and Kawhi Leonard with all of the caveats in there. But like I always say, I like the fact you take shortstops and you take center fielders and then you worry about sorting it out later if you got to move guys around. It's only troubling to me when you draft guys who are already third baseman or already first baseman or already corner outfielders. Just philosophically, I want that guy who is at the most important defensive position until you have to move him somewhere else.
Yeah, I like Jay chiming in on the chat, the Babe effing Ruth comparison with Kyle Schwarber.
Yeah, but that was internal. That was the stuff they would tell each other. That was, you know, Babe effing Ruth just because of the hit tool there. And
how'd that go for him?
Well, it got him a 10 million dollar 1 year deal with the Nats. No, it didn't. It didn't go as well as it should have. And
it's more than Babe Ruth made.
Total? True. I'm sure it is. Yeah, that's the 10 million is absolutely. What was the most Ruth made in a season?
Thinking guy gif.
What was the most?
Man, I'd have to look that up.
What was the most Ruth made in an individual season? But obviously, in today's dollars, it would be different. But there was that 1 year where he made more than the president, and he said that he deserved to, or whatever it is.
I'm seeing a number that says $80,000 a year.
Wow, that's pretty good for then. that's pretty good number for the old Bambino.
Apparently, his salary. Yeah, his salary climbed from $600 to $80,000 a year. So percentage-wise, and how?
Yeah, that's a lot of hookers and cigars. That's the high-end stuff, you know, at that point. So good for the Babe. But, yeah, we'll await other news today. Do you think we might get some insight based on everything that's going on with Bryant and Baez and Contreras with where the ARB numbers have to come in? Could we know more, or could any of that be pushed forward?
Yeah, because DJ LeMahieu, we're seeing reports come down that DJ LeMahieu is likely going to sign with the Yankees. At least that's what I saw before we started our show. I need to double check. So that would also set the market a little bit further on Chris Bryant. That seems to be the scuttlebutt around the league. And after Liam Hendricks, who is now officially with the White Sox and is talking and making funny references apparently on conference calls, go Liam Hendricks. That after he went off the board, we started to see more pitchers, relievers specifically, come off the board as well. So a couple notes here. We mentioned Yoelki Cespedes, who also has excellent eyebrows, like his half-brother Yoenis, by the way. Sox also signed Jorge Vieira, who has a plus-plus fastball, slider, curveball, change, throws like 94 to 97. That was their other signing today, which I thought was pretty cool because you can never have too much pitching. Brad Hand reportedly close with the Mets, that according to Ken Rosenthal. So we're seeing that as well. But then Buster only an hour later says a deal between the Mets and reliever Brad Hand is not close at this time. So I guess we're still trying to figure out where Mr. Hand is going.
If it's our time, Mr. Hand, I have a little pizza on our time. But it's not an official MLB signing until we get the Leila Rahimi eyebrows scouting report, because that's when you know it's a done deal. And until then, it's not.
Hey, is that, man, like the Chandler Hutchison hairline report, which I specialize in? Hey, for all team, like all first team NBA hairline, Chandler Hutchison.
He not does keep close. That pretty tight. He does, actually. Now I'm going to think about that. Except for the Carlos Boozer painted-on hairline.
That was amazing.
Like, I mean, these things happen.
That's the only thing they haven't made Flex Seal actually for in the commercial is hairlines, but Carlos Boozer has already done that.
if Chandler Hutchinson,
I'm trying
could
to see the names coming across.
If Hutchinson could take care of his actual body as well as he takes care of his hairline, he'd be a brilliant basketball player.
This Chandler Hutchinson hairline update, still crispy.
I love it. Bob Nightingale with this 30 minutes ago. Chicago Cubs catcher Victor Caratini gets 1.3.
Okay, even though he's not a Chicago Cub.
Yeah, I was like, wait a second. That doesn't make any sense. Mark Feinstein, the Padres and catcher Victor Caratini settle at $1.3 million per source. So there we go. I was like, huh?
What? So as these roll in, we'll let you know. I know Lawrence Holmes will do the same, and we'll do transition with him next on The Score.